Good morning, everyone. So before the morning session starts, we have the pleasure of having with us Professor Patrice Bourdelain, who's the director of the INSHS, so the National Institute for Human and Social Sciences of CNRS, and directly and indirectly we have received huge support of this institute for our conference, and now he has done us the amitié, I'm not sure how you say that in English, of coming to say hello to all of us this morning, so please.
So, good morning, dear colleagues. Yesterday I was in Marseille, so unable to be here to welcome you, really. But I've not forgotten that I am director d'études at the École d'études en sciences sociales, first of all, and that I have just some years to be in charge of these social sciences and humanities at the CNRS. Some words, maybe, to welcome you and to stress on the fact that the CNRS is recruiting each year specialists, scholars working on East Asia and or on history of science. Sometimes it's the both. It's on East Asia and on history of science, which is perfect for you, of course. I have, yes. So it's our priorities, and it's also the reason why I am here today. It's because the center, the research center, which is organizing this 40th conference is very important for the CNRS. A lot of colleagues there are from the CNRS. And the three organizers too. It's important. The history of science and philosophy of science, but history of science is one of the scientific fields very structured in an international perspective, I think. And scientific community is really existing, organizing events and also, probably more important, is able to identify, for instance, the emergence promising scientific orientations. And it's the reason why these conferences are so important, because it's also a way for the community to meet and to build what is science. And I am used to say the main difference between science and local erudition is precisely that science is done and built in an international context. And it's a very important point for me and for the CNRS. I know already that yesterday was a very interesting first conference day. When you go through the program. Ah, yes, sorry, thank you. When you go through the program, it's very interesting to see the origins of the colleagues, of course, but also the main themes and how everything is linked around some question today, and also with different methodologies. So it's a very important event for all of us, I think. And it's the reason why I wish you a very pleasant, and not only pleasant, but very interesting conference, fruitful for your future research and networks, and also publications, because publications are also important, as you know. And sorry for this too hot temperature this year in Paris in July. It can happen, and it's a little evidence of the global warming, probably. So I hope you will enjoy this conference. Thanks a lot for coming, and I would like, before finishing, to thank a lot the three organizers. There are three from the CNRS, so it's Catherine Jamy, Frédéric Aubringer, and Caroline Bodelec from a very important research team on China, Korea, Japan that we share with the École des études en sciences sociales. So have a nice end of conference, and thanks for coming.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to this plenary session, which is, I think, in the central, right in the central theme of this year's conference, in that it is looking at the local, the regional contacts, circulations, and it is looking at it from the perspective, among other things, of people who are not always considered to be concerned with science and technology, that is to say merchants, but as we know, in the East Asian context, as in the European context, without trade, we would not have this circulation of knowledge, or at least we would have much less. So I hope we shall all remain cool through this. I prefer to think of the heat in the room as something which one of my country's prime ministers described as the white heat of modern technology. We are all sitting here generating thoughts, energy, and ideas, and I think that this plenary is going to give us many more. I'm delighted to introduce this morning François Gipoulou, who is the director of the research group China, Korea, Japan here at the École. He also directs the research program Urba China, Sustainable Urbanization in China, Historical and Comparative Perspectives, and Mega Trends Towards 2050. So this is obviously large in scope, but this does not daunt Monsieur Gipoulou, who counts among his recent major publications a book translated in three languages entitled The Asian Mediterranean, Port Cities and Trading Networks in China, Japan, and Southeast Asia from the 13th to the 21st Centuries, which is truly longue durée, and which leads us, I think, directly into today's lecture, which is entitled Innovation and Entrepreneurship in China's Pre-Modern Economy, Huizhou and Shanxi Merchant Networks Revisited. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francesca. I'm not the director of the China-Korea Research Center anymore, but it's not a problem. I would like to thank, first of all, the organizers of this conference, Frédéric Aubringer, who is now the new director of this center, Catherine Jamy, CNRS, and Caroline Bodelec. I'm very glad to be here. I have to confess that the title of my presentation this morning is slightly different. I will focus only on the Shanxi bankers, on the Shanxi merchants, and the Piaohao. So I would say that from the mid-Qing to the late Qing period, Shanxi merchants were one of the most competitive commercial groups in China. They were involved mainly in salt, tea, copper, and cashing business. This last activity was conducted by Shanxi bankers, or called Piaohao. They played an active role in transferring fiscal revenues from provinces to the central government during the second half of the 19th century. Their business had a great impact on the economy, politics, and culture of China, and has an important place in the commercial history of China. From the outset, the Piaohao presents three original characteristics. First, capital is distributed between owners and employees. Second, company management is separated from asset ownership. And three, salaries are partly converted into shares in the form of what we could today call an incentive plan. Piaohao literally means ticket shop. In fact, it refers to a remittance firm. Piaohao were remitting and cashing money from their clients. They accepted Caixi silver and gave a note in exchange, warranting the possibility to cash the silver at a different place. At the end of the 19th century, in 1894, the Chinese financial market was almost evenly divided between three banking institutions: the Tianzhuang, or money shops, the Piaohao, or Shanxi remittance firms, and the foreign banks, whose capital assets represent one-third of the total. Four decades later, in 1936, at the eve of the Sino-Japanese War, the share of Piaohao was equal to zero. Those of the Chinese banks rose to 77%, and the share of Tianzhuang was only 9%. The remaining, the share of foreign bank, was reduced to 12%. How can we explain such a decline in the share of the Shanxi bankers, who have been praised as the front runners of the banking modern credit providers in China? How can we interpret this failure while Piaohao have been celebrated as the first Chinese entrepreneurs able to clearly separate ownership from management? I would like first to recall the rise and business organization of the Shanxi bankers during the 19th century, and then analyze the main reasons for their decline. Shanxi money changers were based on geographic affiliations, as clans were much less powerful in northern China. Shanxi Piaohao implemented very original methods of commercial organization, capital management, and motivating personnel. Piaohao were organized into a head office, Zhonghao, and branches, Fenghao. Head office were all located in Shanxi, in Pingyao, and in districts of Qi and Taigu. The branches were located in all places where were concentrated industrial and commercial activities. The company owner, or Caidong, did not handle the management of the company directly, but entrusted the managing director, Da Zhangwei, with the right to use funds, to mobilize personnel, and all rights attached to the running of the company to fully promote its capacities. In other words, the separation was very clear between ownership and management. The managing director remained at the head office, Zhonghao, which was the center of power. He handled the management of general affairs, but he was also in charge of all the branches. Once shareholders have discussed it, the managing director decided on the regulation concerning personnel and on the company strategy in terms of deposit, loans, transfers, meaning the dispatch or payment against a bill of exchange. And finally, of exchange transaction, due, otherwise the exchange of notes for cash, one currency for another. The Piaohao branches were strictly controlled. The branch manager may handle on business development, use of funds, and personal management. However, capital allocation, appointment and revocation of personnel, profit distribution, were all decided by the head office. The branches were actually subsidiary companies according to the type of business and the regions. At the end of the year, or the end of the accounting period, generally every 3 or 4 years, the branch head must write a report for the owners and the managing director. The assessment of the director did not lie solely on the amount of profits estimated, but more importantly, on his efficacy in strengthening the whole group of companies he was part of. Whether they were created from equity or joint financing, the Piauha were structures with unlimited responsibility. It is only at the end of the 19th century that the financial companies and institutions put into place a shareholding system of limited liability. Furthermore, the Piauha at first were underfunded, some 10,000 or a little more than 100,000 taels. It is only at the end of the 19th century that, thanks to the injection of additional capital, they possess capital which goes up to 200,000 or 300,000 taels. Was the shareholder system of the Shanxi merchants the product of a development of a system of credit and a cash economy? Did it reflect, as believe Chinese historians, the transformation of commercial capital into financial capital? Some Piauha even explicitly mentioned the separation of ownership and management, as we have said, forbidding the recruitment of personnel related to owners. The management responsibilities were clearly distinguished between capitalist and managing director. Once the contract between these two people was signed, the capitalist no longer interfered in the management of business. Shanxi bankers considered that collecting, analyzing, and using the commercial information were the key to success. In order to keep abreast of the current market conditions, changes in demand, and the state of affairs, the Home Office required all branches for information regarding market dynamics. Usually, this was provided every 3 days by message, every 5 days by letter, and a report at the end of every month. For information security, the Shanxi bankers had their own code. If their report was lost, it was difficult to decipher its content. The directors considered that collecting, classifying, and using information was also an important aspect of personnel assessment. Ownership rights were clearly defined in order to determine responsibility in profit attribution. The soundness of this structure directly influenced its economic efficiency. What can be done and what cannot, what can be owned and what cannot, was clearly stated in the Shanxi companies and played a double role of incentive and constraint. However, this structure was not without flaws, and the decline of the Piauha accelerated toward the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Faced with the upheaval of the domestic and international situation, Shanxi bankers proved to be unable to adapt. None of the family was capable of imposing the kind of coordination able to counteract the competition of Western banks. Several factors could be considered as crucial in the demise of the Shanxi bankers. First, foreign competition and international disorders. After the Opium War, with the entry of foreign capital, large-scale foreign goods were introduced into China, which gave a devastating blow to the national industry, especially facing foreign cloth, floor, fur, and paper making. Shanxi bankers could not adjust their industry and operations and were marginalized. Meanwhile, modern banks had a huge impact on their cashing business. At the end of the 19th century, foreign banks established in Chinese port cities were focusing on one main objective, providing financial services to foreign firms operating in China. They were not involved in interprovincial remittances and therefore were not in direct competition with Shanxi remittance firms. This situation, however, changed with the Boxer Rebellion at the end of the 19th century. This rebellion severely disrupted the financial markets in northern China. The submission pattern of the capital requisitions was then modified. The Piaohao, which continued their operation despite the risk of attacks and plunderings by the rebels, were still allowed to remit the payment. But the other remittance firms will remit the money to the Shanghai Maritime Customs. The money was remitted to the central government in Beijing by the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, Shanghai branch. Piaohao were no longer the only consignee of the government remittance, and their influence diminished. Moreover, the foreign banks were able to attract local clients into port cities and treaty ports where they operated. Instead of depositing money in the local Tianzhuang or Piaohao, Chinese people were inclined to deposit their savings into Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation because it would not go bankrupt easily and were more reliable than local money shops. The evolution was particularly striking in the south, where the Piaohao influence was weak. While Shanxi bankers became wealthy, the government of Qing Dynasty began to fall into serious financial difficulties. Therefore, Shanxi bankers had been their main target for various kinds of donations to the army or to the administration. Because of these forced donations, Shanxi bankers lost huge amount of money. Shanxi bankers had very close relationship with Qing governments for a long time, so they seriously depended on the officials in their commercial activities. It was this dependence that resulted in their operational deterioration. It's interesting to notice that at the beginning, the Imperial Bank of China offered Piaohao to participate in their banking activities in terms of staff recruitment, remittance services, and local branch construction. But the offer was turned down by the Piaohao. In fact, Piaohao were afraid of next requests from the Qing government, as it has been the case in the previous 40 years. The Qing administration had to meet an expanding fiscal demand to suppress the internal rebellions and to pay off the increasing war indemnities to foreign powers. Therefore, the government was regularly extracting money from Piaohao through compulsory levies, donations, and loans. This practice has severely prevented Piaohao from collaborating with the imperial administration during the financial transition that occurred at the end of the 19th century. If we look now at Piaohao's internal weakness, we first look at the lack of capital. Piaohao's initial funding capital was often insufficient compared with other modern Chinese banks. The remittance business needed abundant floating capital to implement a smooth transfer of funds. Piaohao's funding capital was, however, limited. Each Piaohao was initially capitalized with sums ranging from 100,000 to 300,000 silver taels. Thus, each branch was not able to gain more than 10,000 tael on average as its working capital. The second problem was the inability to accumulate sufficient funds due to the scattered structure of capital in the Piaohao. The owners of Shanxi Piaohao usually opened more than one remittance shop, but also invested in other mercantile firms dealing with tea, tobacco, silk, or cloth. If we now examine Piaohao's management methods, we can point out three main problems. First, a serious defect in the management of Piaohao was the fact that corporate shares, Shengu, was much more numerous than silver shares. Corporate shares can be lended for gaining money, but they did not involve the liability of the corporation. Second, the shareholding system of the Piaohao was relying on unlimited responsibility. At the beginning, this helps improving the confidence feelings. However, in crisis times, the branches which were losing money can undermine the financial position of other branches or even the headquarters. Third, the management system was highly patriarchal. One general director makes all the decisions. The accounting methods used by Piao Hao were basically a simple entry system, which lacks the mechanics to keep track of the capital because no record of assets and liabilities were reflected on it. In absence of capital accounts, the account balance did not represent the actual profit. The head office of Piao Hao was unable to keep track of the bad debts of their respective branches. This issue had a very negative impact on the accuracy of the Piao Hao ledgers. Without doubt, the Piao Hao has been a Chinese endogenous financial institution which was well adapted to a centralized administration without foreign competition and without competition from Chinese modern banks either. In that sense, the demise of the Shanxi bankers, once one of the most powerful business associations in China, occurred at a peculiar period of China's history. The search for reform of the late Qing government facing an increasing competition from Western firms in a chain of treaty ports. During this period, China was facing two decisive challenges. First, the unprecedented development of its external trade, and second, the rapid modernization of its industry. Both challenges exerted a strong pressure on China's traditional financial system. The decline of the Shanxi bankers is also linked to a very ancient issue in Chinese economic history, the chronic lack of capital for Chinese entrepreneurs. The various ways of sterilizing scarce capital resources, and last but not least, defective management and accounting methods. To conclude, let me raise some questions. First, no doubt, merchant activities were not despised at the end of the Ming Dynasty, and this trend had also gained momentum during the Qing Dynasty. However, it seems that monopoly was the key factor of success of a given trading or financial network. Be it the case of Huizhou merchant, the 13 Hong, or the Shanxi bankers. The cultivation of links with the bureaucracy was crucial for merchants and financiers. It is an important part of the repertoire of Chinese merchants. It is more important to gain this position than to be competitive with rivals. Second, the lack of financial innovation. However, it seems to have been a crippling weakness. The pound shop and other loan shop or money shops could not properly be called banks, for they were confined to lending money to households and lending working capital to craftsmen. Chinese endogenous institutions did not commit themselves to long-term credit. In fact, capital accumulation doesn't seem to have been the objective of those trading networks or credit institutions. Merchants and economic actors were not motivated to promote financial innovations. Pawn shops never turned into banks. Business associations for a commercial venture never became limited companies until the end of the 19th century. The peculiar process of turning savings into capital was thwarted by several factors we should carefully investigate: high interest rate and the trend of liberalization, periodical liberalization of China's economy. In the last two decades, numerous scholars have reconsidered the relationship between the state and the economy in late imperial China. They also put under scrutiny the various forms of the modernization of administrative practices in the field of economics and trade. Instead of focusing exclusively on quantitative data, which are, in the case of China, scarce and incomplete, or on a normative standard, there is no single yardstick with which to measure the success of economic development, it seems important to identify a set of economic institutions and commercial practices that have played a crucial role in China over the long term. Thank you very much.
Are you willing to take questions? I'm sure there will be many, but while you gather your thoughts and comments and questions, I wanted to ask a question of my own, which was, you spoke throughout of the Shanxi banks, the Shanxi bankers, the Piaohao, as more or less institutions or groups. But I was wondering whether, in any sense, there was a corporate consciousness of the kinds of challenges that they faced, and a discussion, whether among themselves or mediated by the government, how they might respond.
Thank you for your question, Francesca. What I understand of the Shanxi bankers at the end of the 19th century is that they were conscious of the growing threat raised by not foreign banks, but national banks. And what is striking is that they never succeeded in giving a, let's say, united position toward the governments in terms of the offer that the government was giving to them. For instance, when it was this period of edification of modern national modern banking system in China, they wanted to use the experience of Piaohao in setting up branches all over China, but the Piaohao were very suspicious about this proposal because they believed that it was a way of imperial government to divert experience and funding of the Piaohao, as it has been the case in the past. So for me, one reason for the collapse also was their inability to offer a united or unified response to the government initiative at the time.
Sorry, just to follow up on that, since I'm so ignorant, are the Piaohao actually, do they regard themselves as all belonging to a similar, if you like, profession or institution, or do they regard themselves as simply a network of people based in one place rather than another offering services through China? I'm asking this question because in recent banking crises and financial crises, we have had examples of the building societies, say, in Britain, saying, my God, our institutions don't work anymore. We must get together as building societies and see how we could react.
Well, I'm not sure they have this consciousness of belonging to a unique banking or financial system in China, but the fact that they had a network well beyond the boundaries of the northwestern China is also indicating that they were obliged to deal with people in central Yangtze and in southern China as well. So they consider themselves as national bankers in a sense, yes.
Thank you very much for your talk. I have two, I hope, little questions. One is whether these networks were in any kind of competition, because you mentioned that they were dependent on government monopoly in some way, but there were presumably several different networks of different families, so how was the monopoly and this plurality managed? And the other question is whether there was any kind of innovation throughout the centuries or several decades when they were active and successful, or whether the model emerged sometime in the early Qing and then it stayed more or less the same. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your question. When I mentioned the monopoly, I think that I thought of the remittance business from the transfer of fiscal revenues from the provinces to central government in Beijing. Obviously, there were several groups, but a limited amount of groups of Shanxi bankers. They were not very numerous and very scattered, and they were very localized in three or four districts in Shanxi province. So I think that the coexistence between monopoly and three or four big families is not a contradiction. Regarding the innovation, I agree with you along. Well, what is interesting in the Shanxi bankers' history is, contrary to Huizhou merchants or merchants from Fujian, it's a limited period in time. Well, it has been established that the Russian Chang was created in 1823, and the complete collapse of the Shanxi Piaohao is dated at the beginning of the 19th century, or even just after the First World War. So during this one century period, we do have innovations in terms of management of personnel, for instance. You have very precise descriptions of the way one company has to recruit personnel, the kind of competencies is requested for each post in the in the network. But what strikes me is that key financial innovations, like for instance the introduction of a limited liability company, it came very late, and it came under the influence of foreign companies operating in China.
Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. I had the pleasure some years ago of visiting Pingyao and actually going all the way down into the sub basements of a banking establishment there. Their security was really very good. It would have taken a lot of effort to commit a robbery there. It was evident. Discussion of a topic like this, it seems to me, is centrally relevant to much of what we want to talk about in this conference, since the availability of capital for investment in new development was in the countries of northwestern Europe crucial in the Industrial Revolution. And bearing in mind your, if it's not unfair to ask you to consider a longer term, in your abstract you did refer to the Jones question, why was the Sung achievement, which set China's economic development well ahead of other societies in both Europe and Asia, never repeated in China? I wonder if it's too much to ask you if you could look over a rather longer term at the possible institutions for the accumulation and possibly investment of capital in China. I have no idea, I'm afraid, of how things are managed in the Sung. I wonder if you have, I'm sure you have, rather more idea than I have and could share it with us. Thank you.
Well, it's a very big debate, and in my view, it relates to the question of why no capitalism in China. If we consider that capitalism, in the word capitalism, we have capital, and one very successful way of development in Western Europe has been the ability to accumulate capital over time. And in my view, this is not the result of what occurred in the 18th century with the Industrial Revolution also. It's the result of a unique combination we had in the Middle Ages in Europe between political fragmentation on one side and a strong legal tradition, private law. So if we talk about this issue, I think we have also to have a more precise definition of what capitalism is. And for many, well, we have a different school of thought about that, but in my view, capitalism is not an economic system. It's this combination which occurred in a very unique way in Western Europe at the end of the Middle Ages between extremely strong political fragmentation, because no single entity was able to exert its jurisdiction over the whole territory, be it the Pope, the Emperor, the King, or the Lord. And this autonomy of local entities has given way to very peculiar forms of political organization, and we have that with the Republic of the Sea in the case of Italy, for instance. And this has been combined with very strong and very ancient private law tradition. And this set of institutions has developed into the commanda, company, and limited share, limited liability company, and so on. This kind of trajectory, in my view, never occurred in China, because power has been always strongly concentrated, except, well, very well-known periods of disunity and fragmentation in China. And I think that, well, it's also a very big debate, but power in China is linked with knowledge. No, it's not linked with money or religion, as it has been the case in Western Europe. So I don't know if I reply to your question, but at least this is what I can do.
Christian?
Yeah, thank you very much, François, for this very interesting talk and presentation. I would like to focus on the relationship between the merchants. You are, of course, during the presentation, you focused on the merchant system, but you mentioned also the importance of state. And I would like to make some comment on the relationship between merchants and the state as well, because the state has the responsibility to establish, to set up a system with merchants, I mean a reliable system for long term. And the question, or one of the questions in debate, is the place of a crucial system, which is not, perhaps, not irrelevant for us today. This is a public debt, the system of public debt. And during the Song period, there is a kind of public debt in China. And you have mentioned in the talk the ways the state extracts funds from the Piaohao and never afforded a system, a stabilized system for the relationship between the merchants, the bankers, and the central government. And it's not because, in my view, because of the threats of the state, but because of it, of its weakness. So I would like to have your to our opinion, your view about this system of public debt, because as we know, the public debt started with the foreign capital, and after the Opium War as a system, but for the benefit for the foreigners, and not for the Chinese merchants. So it seems to me that the public debt is also to be, we have also to keep in mind this crucial system of the relationship between merchants and government. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for this question. I didn't touch upon this issue during my presentation. I have to confess that it's a very, I think it's a very promising and very interesting field to explore. I have not many elements to answer your question. To my knowledge, well, there is no public debt. There is no heavy public debt in China until the second half of the 19th century, right? So neither the Chinese administration nor the merchants have been induced in developing instruments to deal with this problem. If we compare with what occurred in, for instance, 13th century Venice, you have a public debt because the city needs to pay galleys and the navy. So the development of a public debt has induced merchants to develop specific instruments to operate on this specific market. And this has been a great impact, had a great impact on the development of financial tools, which have been very useful for the development of European economy. So in my view, I agree with you totally. First, the Chinese administration is accounts are well kept until the second half of the Chinese the 19th century. And second, this is kind of a weakness of the administration. They are relying only on foreign bankers to deal with this problem and not relying on their own internal system of Chinese bankers, as for instance, Chen Zhuang or Shanxi bankers, who were unable to cope with this problem of the administration.
Time for one last question over here. Dagmar?
Thank you. I have a question as regards the very brief remark you made on ownership. You said these people had lists on what can be owned and what can be done. Mm-hmm. This is an invitation to elaborate on this, because throughout the period you were talking, I mean, the relation between these merchants as privateers, the state, the families, the villages in which they were operating, mm-hmm. seems to have changed quite a bit. And I wonder, like, how you see that change in the concept of ownership that these people had. So what kind of things were changing in these lists as regard what can be owned and what can be done? Can you give us some examples?
Yes, thank you for this question. There were very precise regulations on how to deal with clients you know personally, the client's money you know personally, with the money coming from the family, from the clan, and in that sense, the separation was rather well defined in the writing regulations of the Shanxi bankers. Because, for instance, it was prohibited to have to accept to use loans from family into the Piaohao organization. There were rather clear delimitation of the money coming from the family or the clan or other merchants involved with the Shanxi bankers. But this is, in my view, maybe a kind of the Chinese historians and people in Caiting Daxue in Shanxi are very much focusing on this, which is clearly a Weberian concept, because for Weber, the one of the criterion for capitalism is the clear separation between ownership and management. But I'm not sure that it will be very well, it's interesting to follow this idea, but maybe we have also to think over endogenous criterion for the management of Shanxi bankers in their own business, and to not only to have necessarily yardsticks which comes from other definition of capitalism.
Catherine, you have a question or you wish to? Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I think we should terminate this very illuminating session. I'm still a little mystified as to how the knowledge circulated among the Shanxi bankers, but I'm going to corner François over coffee and extort that information. And I would like to thank François, after which Catherine Jamy has an announcement to make. So first, many thanks to François Gipoulou for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.